Will you pray with me? Lord, now may the words of my mouth and may the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. One of our many beloved church traditions at this time of year is the lighting of the Advent wreath candles. Over time, the four candles around the wreath have come to represent, for a lot of people, specific Advent themes, though those specific themes vary depending upon who you talk to. For many of us, the four Advent candles represent hope, peace, joy, and love in that order. That makes today, the second Sunday of Advent, the Sunday of peace. I don't know about you, but peace is not what I have been feeling this week. Another school shooting, this one closer to home than ever, causing a ripple effect that has rattled our kids and our teachers and our parents, has shut down some of our schools, has shattered some of our sense, our fragile sense of normal living. I have felt a lot of things this week: horror, outrage, heartbreak, disgust, desperation, fear. I have felt a lot of things, but peace has not been one of them. Peace is elusive for many of us these days. And now here we find ourselves on this second Sunday of Advent, living with a little more darkness each day, watching our days get shorter and our nights get longer, and wishing for a whole lot more than just two candles called hope and peace. We miss our dazzling summer sun. We miss our long days and short nights. We miss our pre-pandemic lives. We miss our pre-Sandy Hook lives and our pre-Columbine lives and our pre-social media lives. We even miss something that never existed, a time when we didn't worry about our kids. And we miss something we aren't sure we ever actually had, something we aren't quite sure we believe in: peace. If you stand in the center of the second floor of the National Gallery Museum in London and look to your right and to your left, you can see the entire length of the gallery. And if you continue to look to your left from the center, you will see an enormous painting at the very, very end of that long hallway, too far away to really make out from the central hall. And if you're like most National Gallery visitors, you will find yourself eventually pulled towards that painting. It's constructed that way, the architecture is, to pull you towards it. You will find yourself pulled down a long hallway flanked by a series of large columns that get smaller the closer you get to that wing that houses the painting. And you will be walking under a series of arches that also get smaller the closer you get, to draw you forward, to draw you in. The hall and the columns and the arches will pull you along through four galleries until you arrive in the newer wing of the museum, the Sainsbury wing. And once you get there, you will walk under even more arches getting smaller until you arrive at the foot of the painting. When you finally get to that painting, you will be standing at the farthest edge of the museum, facing the farthest wall. And the entire space in front of you will be taken up by an oil painting by the Italian Renaissance painter Cima, The Incredulity of St. Thomas. No, it's not an Advent painting. But it is nearly 10 feet high and 8 feet wide, depicting the apostles and the risen Christ in a room that looks like an extension of the room you're standing in. And at the back of the room in the painting, you'll see two more arches, windows that reveal a landscape outside that seems to go on and on. So there you will stand at Jesus' feet, at the farthest edge of the museum, looking up and out at a view that goes even farther. But closer to you, at the front of that painting, stands the apostle named Thomas, the one we call Doubting Thomas. And in the painting, he steps forward and leans towards Jesus, extending his index finger into the risen Christ's open wound while the apostles look on. Rich, bold colors dominate the piece, which once stood in the altar of a Franciscan church in Venice. And though the painting is called The Incredulity of St. Thomas, it actually depicts his conversion from incredulity to belief. It is the moment after Jesus has entered the room and stood among the apostles and said to them, "Peace be with you." But Thomas could have no peace without first seeing the truth for himself. So there he is, finger in the wound, a hint of a smile on his face as he looks up at Jesus, while Jesus looks softly back at him. The other 10 men in the room crowd around, watching. But there's one apostle who is not looking at Thomas or Jesus or at any of the other apostles. Hovering in the background, just behind Jesus, he looks out over Jesus' left shoulder, his fingers steepled together in a gesture of prayer, and his face and body turned completely forward. His eyes look out from the painting, directly at us. And there is something of a question there in his eyes, as if he is asking us, "What about you? What about you?" His eyes push us to ask ourselves, "What about me? Do I doubt? Do I hope? Do I have peace? Do I believe? What would it take for me to believe?" The painting feels like an interrogation. It asks us to consider our own faith and what we need to carry on with it, to keep going in that landscape beyond that doesn't end. When we find ourselves standing at the furthest edge of our knowledge, what will it take for us to hope? To believe, to find peace. Once you have stood at the far north corner of the National Gallery under that huge painting, you only have two choices of where to go next. You can either turn around and go back the way you came, or you can turn left and be drawn deeper into the Sainsbury wing, into smaller and smaller and smaller rooms, pared down, intimate galleries filled with smaller and smaller paintings. Eventually, you will find yourself in a room of 15th century Netherlandish paintings. That room is filled with altarpieces and small portraits, including one of the most famous paintings in the history of European art, Jan van Eyck's Arnolfini portrait. Museum visitors recognize that piece, and so they crowd around it, which can make it easy to miss the dark, unassuming little painting also hanging in that room, an oil on oak panel entitled Nativity at Night by the artist Hirtgen Tot Senjans. It is a tender scene. And it is one of the first realistic night scenes in Northern art, and one of the earliest nighttime nativity images anywhere. In this painting, the night is so deep and so dark that it can be difficult to see Joseph there in the shadows of the stable. It can be difficult to see the ox and the donkey with their heads looming over the manger, peering down at the baby Jesus. The stable is lit up by one light, the light of the Christ child. And it is difficult to see in these representations, but there are actually tiny golden rays of light emanating from him. And you can see that there is a golden glow all around his tiny body, which, unlike Luke's rendition, has not been covered or swaddled with bands of cloth. He's tiny and naked and vulnerable, just born. His light illuminates his mother, who bends towards him with her hands pressed together in prayer. And his light illuminates the adoring angels around him, who each make their own different responses of wonder and awe. Outside the stable, we can look through the crumbling window at the back of the stable and see that outside the stable, there are two lesser lights. An angel lit up like a shooting star against the dark night sky, announcing to the shepherds the birth of the Messiah. And there on the hillside with the sheep and the shepherds, we can see a third source of light, the shepherd's fire, just a flicker compared to the angel in the sky or the baby in the manger. Look and see in this painting how the darkness is not something to be afraid of. It's not fearsome or bad. It's a background for God's light to shine. How could we see it otherwise? This painting would not be tender, touching, moving, cozy, intimate, or peaceful if it were not nighttime. The description by the National Gallery notes that the divine glow from the infant Christ is a pocket of light in the darkness, creating a sense of intimacy and awe, which draws us into the scene. A pocket of light in the darkness. It sounds so cozy and intimate, so warm and inviting. And sure enough, we are invited. Look right there on this side of the manger. There is space there in the painting, a place left for us, a place for us to kneel, to lean towards the vulnerability and humility of the child, which is how God comes to us. We are invited into the darkness so we can see God's light shine. When we find ourselves standing at the furthest edge of all we know, wondering what it will take to find hope and peace, here is where we can start. We kneel. We lean towards vulnerability. We make ourselves humble, and we recognize humility, weakness, darkness, and how God's light is made evident in it. This painting is not an interrogation. It is an invitation. The painting not only invites us into the space by the manger, into that pocket of light in the darkness. See how the light draws our eyes first towards its source, the Christ child. But then when we finally do look away from the manger, from the baby, towards all the other figures in the stable, we see that their eyes too are drawn to him, are completely fixed on him. There is an attentiveness here that does not feel like proof-seeking. It feels like recognition. It feels like hope and peace. There is an attentiveness here that does not come easily to us these days, but that is part of the Advent invitation always. Wake up. Pay attention. Keep awake. Watch. And it's a choice. This responding to this invitation is a choice we can make over and over again, no matter how bad we were at it yesterday. We can make the choice again today to cultivate attentiveness, the mindfulness that can help us look for the coming of Christ into our lives each day. This deep attention that helps us push back against the distractions of our busy lives and create space for Christ. Create space for hope and for peace, just as space has been created for us. The Advent invitation is an invitation to bend attentively towards vulnerability in ourselves and in others. It's an invitation to pay attention to where we find vulnerability and weakness and humility. To not avoid our own vulnerability or resist it in ourselves or others or ignore it. But to walk into the dark and to kneel and to pay attention. This painting is inspired in part by the visions of the 14th century mystic St. Bridget of Sweden. Shortly before her death, St. Bridget had a vision of the birth of Jesus, and she wrote afterwards that in her vision, the baby radiated such an ineffable light and splendor that the sun was not comparable to it. Nor did the candle that St. Joseph had put there give any light at all. the divine light totally annihilating the material light of the candle. In other words, the light of the Christ child does not obliterate all darkness. It outshines all other light. We find ourselves stumbling through dark times. But the darkness is not something to be afraid of. Even though it causes us to wonder, what does it take to have hope and to find peace? Maybe peace is not something that happens by getting the things we want, the way Thomas got to see and touch Jesus in the flesh to get the proof he needed. Maybe peace is not about getting our eternal summer sun and never having conflict with ourselves or with each other and never worrying about our children or anything else. Peace starts small, like a baby. Maybe we shepherd it with our own small acts of hope, our own little flickering lights. Maybe we find that peace comes when we get real, when we get honest about all of our vulnerability and lack of control. Maybe peace comes when we quit fearing the dark and realizing instead we need to be looking for God's light, even when it's as small as a baby. Maybe peace comes when we start making space for it. Maybe it will come when we start paying attention. Maybe it will come when we're willing to kneel. It is true that two candles called hope and peace are not enough, but they are the beginning of enough. Come, Lord Jesus, Prince of Peace.